This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
What a birth certificate is that membership card for society that basically opens doors to health and education and protection.
That's James Elder with UNICEF on the importance of birth certificates in Africa. Details coming up also. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari wants to limit food imports. And violations against children in Mali are skyrocketing as security in this war torn country continues to deteriorate. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, since President Muhammadu Buhari took office in 2015, Nigeria's central bank has presided over policies aimed at stimulating growth in the agricultural sector to reduce depending on oil. Yesterday, Buhari told the central bank to stop providing funding for food imports. To discuss the ramifications of the president's directive internally and externally, we have in studio VOA's Hausa Service Managing Editor, Aliyu Mustafa. Welcome to Africa News Tonight. UNICEF has renewed its call for African governments to ensure that the births of all children are registered and that formal birth certificates are provided to their families. This helps ensure that those children will be officially included in society and benefit from government health care, school enrollment, and future employment opportunities. Today, only half of the sub-Saharan Africa's children are registered. If that trend continues, there will be 115 million unregistered children by 2030. To find out more about the importance of British registrations and certificates, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with James Elder, UNICEF's communication chief for Eastern and Southern Africa.
For so many parts of the world, a birth certificate is simply a nice piece of paper that we keep in a drawer. But what a birth certificate is that membership card for society that basically opens doors to health and education and protection. Without that, these children, before they can even walk and talk, are already excluded, already risk being on the margins, already risk vulnerability, whether it's early marriage or child labour or trafficking and illegal adoption networks, which are on the rise. So that's the scope of the problem. The good news is that we've seen that when you link registering at birth with a health centre, you can double birth registration rates. And we've seen that. Uganda, Namibia, Ghana, Mali, Ethiopia, they have doubled them. So don't let a mother have to come back and leave other children and carry a child to go through that bureaucracy, do it at the point of birth, and the numbers change dramatically.
But a large number of African women still give birth at home, far away from a birth center or hospital.
Yeah, a lot of people still don't give birth in health centres, but increasingly across sub-Saharan Africa, we are getting mobile health clinics, we're getting outreach from community workers, so we are more and more getting trained medical staff with those mums at the time of delivery. And if that's the case, we can also get them a birth certificate. Now, of course, if mothers aren't giving birth with any health staff or near any health centre, of course, it's a health problem, and it's going to be difficult to get them a birth certificate. It's also important to remember that we're not just talking about birth certificates so that children can access quality education or access healthcare or, of course, have greater safety. Birth certificates are also really critical because they give the government the ability to count how many kids they've got. And if a government doesn't know how many children there are, then they can't possibly budget around healthcare and education. And it has ramifications from a child's life all the way through schooling, through their chance to get a job. So it's very much a case of being right in practice, but right in principle as well.
Birth certificates have always been important, of course, but it seems that UNICEF is stressing the urgency of birth registrations now in today's Africa. Why?
Right now, Africa is experiencing this population shift that's essentially unprecedented in its scale and size and swiftness in human history. You know, we're looking in the next few decades, about 1.8 billion babies being born in Africa. Now, that means we've got to get the basics right. let's get these children a birth certificate and then move through to quality education and healthcare, then we know that as young adults, we give them a much better chance of being productively employed. And we know when that happens, this is Africa's great chance for increased production, for increased savings, and to get this economic boom that could finally drastically reduce poverty. This is not a once-in-a-lifetime chance. This is a once-in-a-100-year chance. And again, we're talking sub-Saharan Africa where 3 in 4 people are still under $2 a day. And if you don't give them birth certificates, if you don't give them quality education, if you leave them on the margins of society, then you've got tens of millions of unemployed young people with all the flow-on effects of stability, security, unemployment, deprivation. So it's the moment for the continent right now and in the coming few years. And the beauty of it is it's not so difficult as long as these systems are brought together. If there wasn't something simple, we would have an even bigger problem.
That was James Elder, spokesman for UNICEF for Eastern and Southern Africa. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Since President Muhammadu Buhari took office in 2015, Nigeria's central bank has presided over policies aimed at stimulating growth in the agricultural sector to reduce dependence on oil. Yesterday, Buhari told the central bank to stop providing funding for food imports. To discuss the ramifications of the president's directive internally and externally, we have in studio VOA's Hausa Service Managing Editor, Aliyu Mustafa. Welcome to African News Tonight.
Thank you very much.
Aliyu, limiting food imports was one of his campaign promises. Is it good for Nigeria?
Well, it certainly feels like it is good for Nigeria. Buhari is doing this primarily for 3 reasons. One, he's doing it to save money. Foreign exchange is scarce. He's doing it to boost domestic production of food, and he's doing it to encourage farmers. This is nothing new with Buhari. Buhari has been campaigning on this particular topic for more than, God knows, more than 30 years, since he was actually he was a military leader in Nigeria. And like you rightly pointed out, this is what he campaigned on during the past 2 presidential campaigns that he ran in 2015 and 2019. And in the remarks he made in Katsina, he stated that there are many states in Nigeria which are currently producing rice, like Kano, Jigawa, Kebbi, and others. But the impact is already being felt in Nigeria, where food is now much cheaper than it was many years back when Nigeria was importing, say, rice from Thailand. That policy has always been under sharp criticism anyway. So this is a very popular policy. Not all Buhari's policies are popular, but this is one of those that people like very much.
It looks like this is an effort to bring about a steady improvement in agricultural production and attainment of full food security. Is this the kind of move that other African countries can emulate?
Well, there's a good side, there's a bad side. The good side is that Nigerians themselves are happy with the policy because it provides domestic and domestic food production within the country. It eliminates any fears that people have had in the past over the health, the quality of the food that was being imported into the country. That is the good thing. The negative thing is for Nigeria's neighbors, you know, which used to sell to Nigeria food items. Since Buhari decided to implement this policy, that has been a very difficult situation for them because they can now no longer sell any food to Nigeria. And if you are not selling to Nigeria, which is the most populous black nation on the face of the earth, then you are not making really a lot of money and your farmers are in dire, in serious trouble, really. They are far from everywhere else, and if the biggest country around them isn't buying, then there's a problem.
Talk to me about the central bank's status as an independent body. The Central Bank Act of 2007 makes it clear that the bank is independent. It is not supposed to be taking direct instructions from politicians.
I don't think anybody is independent. I think that is just talk on paper. In our current situation in Africa, and in fact the rest of the world, the government cannot just sit by and allow things to happen that it does not like. The central bank obviously takes orders from the government. It is part and parcel of the Nigerian government. It is under the direct supervision of the Federal Ministry of Finance. So it does take orders from the government. And Buhari specifically went out of his way this time around to make sure that he didn't even say don't give them money. He said don't even change money for them. Don't turn the local money into foreign currency for them to be able to buy food from outside.
And lastly, a curb on foreign exchange for food imports could backfire after Buhari's last month signed to the African Continental Free Trade Agreement. That deal seeks to create a continent-wide free trade zone where tariffs on most goods would be eliminated.
You know, the central focus of that meeting was the idea these African countries have to have a single currency. That is one. But certainly everybody knows that each of these countries has its own domestic policies to encourage its own people for self-sustenance and independence from other nations in terms of the production or productivity of items within the country. So while it is likely to toughen things up and roughen things up actually for the neighbors, it is not supposed to be everlasting.
Mariam Ajami was trafficked from Senegal to France at the age of 13 to work as a prostitute. Later, she lived in a refugee center before making her way to Britain, where Jami became interested in computer programming. She became a success, and now she has made it her mission to teach 1 million women and girls, including refugees, how to program by 2030. Ruud Elmendorp reports from the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya.
We're not psychotherapists. We are business people.
We're in a classroom in Kenya's Kakuma refugee camp. Students look at Senegalese technologist Mariam Jam. She's dressed in a colorful African dress and is giving the students a lesson.
So I want you to just recap what we've learned.
She's also telling the students about her I Am the Code movement, which aims to teach 1 million women and girls, including refugees, how to program computers by 2030.
Mentees and mentors, you and I.
Mariam Jam was brought to the Kakuma refugee camp through the Young Global Leaders Program of the World Economic Forum. She's here to teach and inspire others to overcome hardship, as she did.
And at 13 years old, I was taken away from my country, Senegal, to France. So I really suffered as a young girl growing up in a suite of France as a young prostitute. And at the age of 16, I was picked up by the French police under the tube station and sent to a refuge center where I grew up. And then I ended up in the UK when I was 18.
In Britain, Jam, driven by a love for math and science, taught herself computer programming. She's now the CEO of a business consultancy firm and has advised organizations such as Google, Ernst & Young, Microsoft and UN Women, in addition to many African governments. Now she wants to help other girl refugees learn 21st century skills and escape lives of poverty.
And so I really understand what the refugee girls are going through, dreaming, not having enough, suffering from loss and pain and difficulties. I understand where they're coming from. And that's why always people ask me, where is this passion coming from? It's coming from there because I understand them. I've been there as a child like them.
Elizabeth Adith is a refugee from South Sudan who's benefiting from the program.
I Am the Code will really help me because it will equip me with skills that will help me to compete with other communities and other counties because it will give me skills in technology. So that is really very helpful.
There's still a long way to go to reach Jam's goal to teach 1 million women and girls. But since 2011, I Am the Code has trained thousands of women and girls. And that's something to celebrate, especially in a refugee camp. Ruud Elmendorp for VOA News, Kakuma, Kenya.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Here's a recap of our top stories. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari wants to limit food imports. And UNICEF has renewed its call for African governments to ensure that the births of all children are registered. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. In South Sudan, the November deadline to form the revitalized transitional government of national unity is quickly approaching, and one expert says it's unlikely that deadline will be met. At least 24 required tasks have been completed under the peace deal, according to Brian Adeba, deputy director of policy at the Washington-based Enough Project, but that does not include the more contentious issues that are still unresolved.
Among those that are pending is the critical issue of troop cantonment and the unification of the forces. So that has not happened. And then, of course, there is the issue of the most contentious issues here, which is the Independent Boundaries Commission. So there is no conclusive recommendation on the number of states at this particular moment, which means there is a deadlock. And then there's the issue, of course, of demobilization and disarmament commission, the formation of that. So this is the DDR commission. This is related to, of course, cantonment of troops and the unified training of all the troops that are fighting, including the government and the government troops and the SPLM-IO troops. So cantonment has not happened. And if cantonment does not happen, there is no peace deal, so to speak of. And it behooves of those who are in leadership right now to dedicate the resources that are required to ensure that cantonment, troop cantonment, happens. With regard to your question of whether the government of national unity will be formed on November 12th, I think that if we look at the expressions of the most senior people in government about the possibility of meeting this deadline, the news is not good. Salva Kiir himself, the president of the Republic of South Sudan, has said that he believes it will not happen and he believes more time is needed. So, like all the others, I believe that the November 12th deadline is not going to be met. The formation of that of the government of national unity will not be met.
Brian, what do you think is contributing to the lag of forming the unity government? You mentioned that there's 69 tasks, 27 have been completed. What is the issue? Was the timeline too ambitious? What's going on?
No, it's not that the timeline is ambitious. What we're seeing really is the lack of political will needed to ensure that troop cantonment and the training of unified forces takes place. This lack of political will is manifested in the foot dragging in ensuring that there are resources, money, for troop cantonment. We don't see that. The government is not forking out the money that is needed for troop cantonment. Now, the government will say that it doesn't have the resources right now.
Who is responsible for making sure that those resources are there? Is it the South Sudanese government? Is it Western partners? Who's responsible for that?
Western partners have long ago decided that they're not going to fund anything related to this peace agreement. So the responsibility primarily falls on the government of South Sudan. And the government of South Sudan is displaying a lukewarm response to ensuring that there are resources for troop cantonment. Now, the government will say, of course, that it doesn't have the money. Yet we have seen in the media money that is earmarked for the peace process being diverted by senior government officials for other purposes, like purchasing houses and buying expensive luxury vehicles. So there is a problem right there. And so if this doesn't change, and it's unlikely to change, the formation of the government of national unity will not happen because there is no, you know, the security arrangements are not complete. And this agreement is underpinned by those, by these security arrangements. And if they're not there, therefore, it doesn't. The peace deal doesn't happen.
That was Brian Adebe, the deputy director of policy at the Washington-based Enough Project. He was speaking to Ayan Deng-Bior from Washington. Two African countries Chad and Somalia were struck by terrorist attacks today. In Chad, a female suicide bomber linked to Boko Haram blew herself up in western Lac province near Lake Chad. An army spokesman told the French press agency that the attacker killed herself and six others. Among the dead were four guards and a soldier. Boko Haram has launched at least 10 cross-border attacks in Chad since 2018. Its campaign has left about 27,000 people dead and 2 million displaced in Nigeria alone. In southern Somalia today, two car bombs linked to the terror group Al-Shabaab struck a military compound. The group says the attack killed about 50 soldiers in Audigili district, 70 kilometers southwest of the capital Mogadishu. Military officials told VOA Somali Service that no soldiers were killed. The government has not yet confirmed the number of casualties. Last week, the military captured most parts of the agriculturally rich area. Al-Shabaab is fighting the government in Mogadishu in an effort to impose a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Uganda's para badminton team is preparing for the World Championships in Basel, Switzerland later this month. The team has the second highest ranked player in Africa and aims to compete at the 2020 Summer Paralympic Game in Tokyo, where para badminton will make its debut. But as Halima Atumani reports from Kampala, limited resources make their participation uncertain.
Elizabeth Mwesigwa is Uganda's para badminton champion and the second highest ranking player in Africa. The team is doing its best to prepare for the Para Badminton World Championships in Basel, Switzerland, starting August 20. But Mwesigwa says they are sorely under-resourced, have to buy their own equipment and often train themselves.
Getting shuttles, getting everything, plus the shoe, clothes, everything. It's somehow expensive. Plus the coaches. Sometimes we reach at the court, we train without coach.
Para players need specialized equipment such as wheelchairs. But for travel to the World Championships in Switzerland, they will get support. Mugabe Simon is the chief executive officer of the Uganda Badminton Association.
Our team as Uganda is prepared because we have come a long way. As you have seen them today, it's not that they have just started training. They have been, of course, in various trainings before this.
Uganda's players look forward to the international exposure despite the challenges they face at home. Kasirye Paddy is Uganda's number two ranked para badminton player.
Like for me, I'm working, then after, then I come for training because the government cannot pay you, but I like the game. So that's what gives me confidence that I'm getting challenges from people who are better than me.
Para badminton will make its debut at the 2020 Summer Paralympic Games in Tokyo. The event in Basel will be the first Paralympic qualifier. Although Mwesigwa's high-ranking position in Africa qualifies her for the Tokyo Games, it's not yet clear if the team will get enough support to travel to Japan. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll have an in-depth discussion on child marriage and how girls are valued around the world. Married teenage girls are often physically abused and forced into lives of chores and childbearing. The worth of a girl on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 22:30 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.